imagine someone telling you that your assignment is to prevent tomorrow's sunrise? It's ridiculous, right? No one can do that. Today on Truth for Life, Alistair Begg uses a similar illustration to describe an equally impossible assignment that was given to the guards after Jesus' crucifixion. We're focusing on the closing verses in chapter 27 of Matthew's Gospel.
Here at the end of Matthew's Gospel, we're introduced to a group of soldiers who were given an impossible assignment. An impossible assignment. Like it enlist someone this morning and say, what I want you to do is to get up early tomorrow morning and simply by shouting, stop, I want you to prevent the sun from rising in the sky. An impossible assignment. In fact, a ridiculous assignment. And equally ridiculous and equally impossible is the assignment that we discover here in Matthew 27 that is given to these soldiers. Did these Pharisees and scribes really believe that they could contain this Christ and the story of this Christ as a result of their futile plans? Jesus had already said to his disciples, we are going up to Jerusalem. And he did. And the Son of Man will be betrayed. And he was. To the chief priests and teachers of the law. Exactly. They will condemn him to death, and they did. And they will turn him over to the Gentiles, which they did, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him, which they did. And 3 days later, he will rise again. And the Pharisees were bright enough to realize that so far everything had happened just as Jesus said it would. And so they assign this platoon of men to an impossible task. I want you to notice with me, if you would, 3 scenes. The first scene from verse 62 and following of Matthew 27, where we discover that the guard is stationed. The guard is stationed. Notice in passing in verse 62 that these religious figures were really quite unscrupulous characters. A few days before, if you read the record, you will discover that they wouldn't even enter the court of the Gentiles. When a big crowd was watching them, they said, oh no, we are very devout religious people. We don't go in the court of the Gentiles. And the people said, my, my, what religious people they are. But where are they on this morning? They're in the court of the Gentiles. And why are they there? They're there because they need to be there, as they understand it. And so their religious scruples are foundering on the rocks of pragmatism. Now notice, will you, the possibility which they accepted. They go to Pilate and they say to him, verse 63, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, no mention of Jesus the Christ, after 3 days, I will rise again. So what's their problem? Did they believe he was going to rise again? Well, they say they didn't. The reason that they give for this order is in verse 64, because they're concerned that the disciples might come and steal the body away. Well, we know, don't we, that they credited the disciples with more than that which they were capable of. Because the disciples had no thought of stealing the body away. The disciples were more concerned about somebody stealing their bodies away. They weren't out there just waiting for a chance to storm the tomb. They were gone. They were history books. And so the Pharisees credited them with more than they were worthy of. And yet, still they said, maybe they'll come. You know, I don't think that the Pharisees were cutting it straight here. I think the Pharisees thought that Jesus just might rise from the dead. Because the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. They taught the truth of the resurrection. It was orthodox for a Pharisee to believe in an afterlife and for the reality of resurrection. And so written into their teaching and into their thinking was the notion of this afterlife. But they had a problem. They had the Sadducees with them. And the Sadducees, who did not believe in the resurrection, who were scoffers about it all, which is why in the standard Easter Sunday morning joke, they were sad, you see. And they had these individuals who had no notion of a resurrection. They believed in a resurrection. How could the Pharisees convince the Sadducees that they needed a guard at the tomb? Why would the Sadducees want a guard at a tomb? That was ridiculous. The only way that the Pharisees could get these other fellows to come with them was to press the power button. You see, because the Sadducees liked power. And they liked being able to rule and control the people. And so the Pharisees said, you know what? If we don't stamp this down, the gains that we have made, we may lose. So we'll go to Pilate together and we'll face the possibility of this kind of plot on the part of his disciples. And they say to one another, you know, if the notion of him being a Messiah caused trouble, this is verse 64, it'll be nothing compared to the havoc which will ensue if the idea of a resurrected Messiah gets out. So they're real smart guys. We've had a big problem, gentlemen. You will agree to that, right? Jesus has been a major problem for us. Agreed? Yes. Well, let me tell you this. If you think that was a problem, just the idea that he was a Messiah, you ain't seen nothing when they hit the street saying he's a resurrected Messiah. So be sensible and let's appoint the guard. Fine, the Sadducees are convinced and so they take the action. And there is a security that they arrange. The task is straightforward. Make the body as secure as is humanly possible. A large stone had been rolled across the entrance to the tomb. We're told that in verse 60. And now it is sealed. We should not think of them taking concrete, as it were, and making it impossible to roll away the stone. But rather, the picture we ought to have in mind is that of the ancient approach to letter writing, where you would attach a seal on the back of a letter and with a cord or something and a little bit of wax and with an insignia, you would mark it for the opening only by a certain individual. And that's exactly what took place. And so having taken a stone and taking a seal, they then took a group of soldiers. A guard could be as many as 60. We're not told how many, but a guard in Roman terminology could amount to as many as 60 men, and they were posted to provide continual surveillance of the scene. If it were in modern times, they would have used infrared technology, they would have used scanning cameras, they would have used all the micro technology of the day set up in surveillance over the tomb. Here was man at his best shot with this Galilean carpenter over and done with for sure. It's a ridiculous sight, I put it to you. It's man at his most foolish. It is as stupid an idea as trying to contain a lion, the king of the jungle, in cardboard boxes picked up from the local grocery store. And nevertheless, they went about the business. The guard was stationed. Secondly, turn over into chapter 28 and notice in verses 2 to 4 that the guard was stunned. The guard was stunned. Notice the reality that they encountered. This is the second earthquake in a matter of days. Matthew 27 and verse 51 tells us that at the moment the curtain in the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, the earth shook and the rocks split. So these days were marked by strange and extra-dimensional events, the darkness in the middle of the day and the rocks moving around and all of these things going on. And so the guards take their place and God speaks. Jesus' lips are silent, but God speaks. And when you read in the Bible about earthquakes, you discover that earthquakes display God's power and his greatness. They denote his presence and his intervention among men. Read about it all the way through the Old Testament. And so these guards, man, they're in deep trouble. Isn't it significant that we have no description of the resurrection anywhere? No detailed accounts. Come on, you liberal scholars that tell me that the first century church made up the resurrection. Come on, I read you in the Plain Dealer with all your advanced learning, supposedly. They made it up in the first century, did they? There was no resurrection. Okay, well, fine. If they made it up, why did they not give us a detailed account of it? Blow by blow and piece by piece. If you were wanting to fabricate a mythology, you provide as much detail of the event as possible. There is no detail of the event. There was no detail of the event given. It was not made up. It is, in fact, reality, even as the scriptures tell it. And why was there an earthquake? Because an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, a heavenly messenger with an easy task to roll back the stone in order that people might be able to go to the tomb and find it empty. And he sits in a triumphant display of victory. Meanwhile, what are the guards doing? Well, there is a reality they experienced, and there is also an insensibility that overtook them. Notice what happens. His presence was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. And the guards were so afraid of him that they shook, and they became like dead men. You know, big, tough soldiers are big, tough soldiers, right? They're not put off by these kind of things. And this was an easy one for them. This was a pancake job. What do we have to do? Well, it's easy. This is what you do. You go to a tomb where there's a dead man and you guard it. Fantastic. Good. You know, I was saying to one, hey, bring the dice, man. This is easy. You know, let's bring something to drink. This is a trip. And so there they sit, not expecting anything to happen at all. The earthquake was one thing. They'd already got used to that. But this angel really freaked them out. Look at this, what we're told. In the Greek, the word for earthquake is seismos, from which we get our English word seismic. The same word is used of the shaking of these individuals, the same root, eisthenes. And the question is, what was shaking most, the earth or the soldiers? They were so afraid of him, and they shook, and they became like dead men. They were scared stiff. That's what it says. Stiff. Stiff as boards. So they went, said, hey, you know, guard the tomb. What's that? That's no problem. And suddenly they're flat on their backs, zonked. The stone, the seal, the soldiers. What a sense of security they'd provided. And in a moment, as the psalmist says, Psalm 46:6, God speaks and the earth melts. The Father looks from heaven and he laughs. Is this your best shot, he says? Thirdly and finally, scene 3, the guards stifled. You can pick it up at verse 11. The women are on their way to tell their disciples. And who is God going to use to tell the chief priests? I love this. The guards. The Jews put the guards there to confound the purposes of God. God put the guards there because he needed somebody to go tell the chief priests that Jesus was actually alive from the dead. And in all the affairs of time and man, God remains in control. And so to some of them, not to all of them, these guards have begun to scatter themselves. Some of the guards went, verse 11, into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. Now the Sadducees were scrambling for their own explanation because they didn't believe in a resurrection. And the Pharisees now were in big trouble. Because they knew that resurrection was possible and real, and now it would appear that exactly what he said had happened. So what do? Well, they'd used treachery to arrest Jesus. They'd used illegality to try Jesus in a mockery of a trial. And so now they used bribery to attempt to silence the truth about him. They had assigned the soldiers, and part one didn't work. And now so they try Plan B. What we'll do is we'll send them out with this cock and bull story about the fact that the disciples came during the night and stole him away while he was asleep. Do you think they could, with a blatant lie, silence the greatest story ever told? Notice these soldiers, the money they took. Verse 12 tells us it was a large sum of money. These religious leaders were quick with the money. When it proved to be the key to fulfilling their evil plans. Actually, the word here for money is argyria, which is silver money. Do you remember silver money being used before? They bought Judas cheap. 30 pieces was all it took for Judas. Must have cost them a lot for a whole Roman guard because everybody wanted their cut. Make sure, they said, when you negotiate it, make sure it's a big pot because this has got to go around, you know. And so they had to shell out. They were prepared, notice this, to pay dearly for an explanation of the empty tomb which denied the resurrection. And loved ones this morning, nothing very much has changed. Men and women this morning are still prepared to pay dearly for an explanation of the empty tomb, which denies the truth which Scripture proclaims. They gave them the money and they gave them an insurance policy that if the governor found out, they would take care of them. Verse 15, and so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. You know, it wasn't easy for them. They had to weigh the pain of admitting that they fell asleep. If you're a crack soldier, you don't want to go out and tell people you fell asleep. Well, but there's all that lovely money. Well, I got the pain of saying I fell asleep, but I got the profit that comes from this. Pain, profit, pain. Profit. So what happened down there? Oh, we fell asleep. They went out and tell a blatant lie, which gained wide circulation. Even as Matthew writes, we read at the very end of the verse 15 there, the story was still going around among the Jews to the very day of Matthew's writing. Even in the 12th century, people were saying that Judas had stolen Jesus from the tomb, that he was the thief. The story was prevalent then. It's been prevalent through history, and it's prevalent this morning. It's the same kind of story, the same kind of nonsense. Why? Because it suits men and women's interests not to believe that Jesus is alive. It suits their interest to be able to thumb their nose at God and go on their journey. It suits their interest to believe that Easter is a mythology. It's something that we should just give credence to once a year and roll ourselves through. And down through the years, people have argued, well, you know, his body was stolen. The Roman soldiers' theory, he was stolen by the Jews. Well, listen, if he was stolen by the Jews, why didn't the Jews produce the body? Because they were the ones who were saying he was dead, right? So if they were interested in affirming the fact of his death, all they had to do was take the body and put it in the middle of Jerusalem and say, look, don't let anybody live with any nonsense. Jesus is dead. Some said the disciples stole the body. That's such an amazing notion, isn't it? That these disciples who had split immediately he was crucified somehow mustered up enough courage to go steal the body. And despite the fact that the body was dead, they dragged it away and hid it somewhere else, despite the fact that it was in a very nice tomb provided by Joseph. It was in a very suitable spot. And then they went out and they got themselves executed on the basis of this notion. They would never have stood up to the persecution and death which was theirs if they had simply removed the body and buried it somewhere. Now, do you see why Matthew records this? He doesn't record this just as an interesting story. He records it to say to his readers, and we are his readers this morning, listen, it is utterly ridiculous to deny the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Let's give it a concrete feel, shall we? Here's the soldier as he comes now out into the streets of Jerusalem. One of his friends asks him, hey, George, I hear the tomb is empty. What in the world happened? Hey, I'm embarrassed to tell you, but we fell asleep. And they came and whipped him. The guy said, oh, that's fine. Yeah. He goes a little bit further and somebody else says, hey, what's that stuff about the empty tomb? Gives them the same standard response. The guy stands back in amazement. He says, you know what? You guys are something else. How many of you were there in there? Somewhere between a dozen and 60, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. He fell asleep. Yeah. Everybody fell asleep. Yeah. Everybody fell sound asleep. Yeah. I mean, so sound asleep that 11 guys come clattering and battering through the graveyard, roll this big stone over on its side, go in, undress Christ, fold up all the grave clothes in perfect position, and then manhandle him back out through the garden, and not one of you jokers woke up? That's right. When he did that, man, he jingled his silver coins in his left-hand pocket because he realized what an idiot he sounded, and somebody else who was listening to the story said, hey, wait a minute. Were you sleeping as well, George? Yeah, I was. And everyone was sleeping? Yeah, they were. Well, hey, George, I've got a question for you. How do you know the disciples stole him? If you were all sound asleep, where do you get the evidence for the theft? Who told you that's what happened? Or did you guess? Or did you make it up? And in a moment, the mythology was obvious to all. You know, here's the thing this morning, men and women. It's not so much that here in this great land, men and women have been sifting the evidence for the resurrection and rejecting it. Rather, it is that they've never even considered the evidence. Either that they have never had it presented, nor that they have been unwilling to listen to it. What about you this morning? Have you considered this evidence? Certainly, evidence in and of itself doesn't compel belief. If evidence even in and of itself compelled belief, then there would be no smoking now in America. For it is incontrovertible evidence that smoking and lung cancer are linked. Everybody knows that. It is absolutely documented proof. But do people still smoke? Yeah, why? Is the problem with the evidence? No. The problem is with the response of the individual. The problem I put to you this morning concerning Jesus Christ is not with the evidence. We are the problem. We are the ones who don't want to believe. We're the ones who say, I'm agnostic and proud of it. Do you know what the Latin translation of agnostic is? Ignoramus. So if you want to admit to being an ignoramus, that's your problem. That's fine. So you're an ignoramus. Fine. You admit to being totally ignorant of the things of Jesus. Then I say to you this morning, don't live with that label over your head. Consider the evidence. It is not that the evidence has been examined and rejected. It is that the evidence remains untouched. And the reason being that men and women have a sneaking suspicion that this Christ has a claim upon their life. And I want to tell you this morning, yes, he does. Ultimately, belief in Jesus and belief in the resurrection is a matter of faith, but it is not a leap in the dark. It is based on evidence that is powerfully persuasive. So I ask you this morning, what then will you do with this Jesus who is called the Christ? Please do not walk out from here believing for one moment that somehow it's kind of an irrelevancy, that somehow it's a kind of esoteric interest for just a small group of people. Loved ones, if Jesus is alive from the dead this morning, we will one day reckon with him as our judge. And because of his love and his mercy, he speaks into our hearts saying, would you not bow before me as your Savior so that you need not meet me as your judge? That is the message of Easter. That's good news. And the response is there for each of us.
You're listening to Truth for Life. That is Alistair Begg with an essential question to consider. What will you do with this Jesus? Often when we speak about Jesus, we focus on his death and resurrection, both of which are vitally important. But what is equally important is what happened after the resurrection. The fact that Jesus is now reigning in heaven, interceding on our behalf. And the book we want to recommend to you this month is a book that covers this topic. It's called Man of Sorrows, King of Glory. It's a perfect book to read during this month as we celebrate all that Jesus has accomplished for us on the cross and through the empty tomb. Request your copy of the book Man of Sorrows, King of Glory today. When you give a donation to support the teaching ministry of Truth for Life, visit truthforlife.org/donate or call us at 888-588-7884. I'm Bob Lapine. We are so glad you joined us today. Jesus' death and resurrection are pivotal events in history, and yet many remain skeptical, or they flat out reject the truth of the events surrounding Easter. So what gave the Apostle Paul such confidence when he proclaimed the gospel? We'll find out tomorrow. The Bible teaching of Alistair Begg is furnished by Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.